Good morning and welcome back. I'm Grace Mentor and I'll be moderating this session today. At this time, please silence your cell phones and take your hats off. There's a place in the back of the room, that white table, for your hats. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors of the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays in the hallway out there, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo to say thank you. We couldn't do this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corvetta, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Reba Agrofinance, State's Advanced Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Our next presentation is Leases, Why and How, presented by Tiffany Dial-Lashmet. Tiffany is an assistant professor and extension specialist in agricultural law with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. She focuses her work on legal issues affecting Texas agricultural producers and landowners, including agricultural leases, water law, oil and gas law, eminent domain, easements, and landowner liability. She serves on the board of directors for the American Agricultural Law Association and is part of the State Bar of Texas John Hoffaker Agricultural Law Course Planning Committee. In 2016, Tiffany was named the State Specialist of the Year for Texas Agriculture by the Texas County Agricultural Agents Association. Tiffany grew up on a family farm and ranch in eastern New Mexico, received her Bachelor of Science in Agribusiness, Farm and Ranch Management, summa cum laude, at Oklahoma State University, and her law degree, summa cum laude, at the University of New Mexico. Prior to joining Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, Tiffany worked for 4 years at a law firm in Albuquerque, practicing law, civil litigation. She's licensed to practice in New Mexico and Texas. She lives in the Panhandle with her husband and 2 children. Please join me in welcoming her.
Good morning. Can you guys hear me okay with this? Is this mic good? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming today. I'm excited to be here. We will kick off like I do all of my sessions. So if you've been before, you know what pictures are coming. I like to say I am a lawyer, and I know no one likes lawyers. So I always try to bring pictures to defend myself. Oh, no, they're not on there right. Well, I'll just use this one. It's my kids. So I like to tell folks I am a farm kid raising farm kids, and that's my most important title. This picture here, these 2 kids were tasked with teaching their doggy bottle lamb to walk on a halter. And they drug her around the yard for a while, and pretty soon I looked up, and they've got her loaded in the back of their pickup. And my son told me, she'll go anywhere we want now. Farm kids are resourceful, and that's important, I think. So I always like to show these pictures because I think it's important for you to know. I try to come at this from a practical level. My family's been involved in agriculture for generations. We lease land now. We are landowners with tenants now. And so I try to come at this leasing stuff, especially with some practical knowledge, and I'll try to share some war stories, as you'll hear about in a few minutes. Anytime I speak, I like to welcome questions as we go. So as we go along, if you all have questions, please raise your hand. I'm happy to take those. I'll also try to leave some time at the end to answer questions as well. When I speak, they make me give a little disclaimer. I'm a lawyer. I'm not your lawyer. Right? If you need specific legal advice, we're going to have to go find someone for you to hire. I'm not giving you advice today, just general information. One other thing I want to mention are a couple of upcoming programs that I've got. And I've got flyers for these up here in the front if you want to grab one before you leave. Or they're also at the Ag Workers booth down in the expo. We've got 2 big sets of programs coming up. And as you'll see, we're going to different locations across the state. The first one there is called Owning a Piece of Texas. That's a free program. It's all day. You'll get a free lunch. And it's basically just ag laws that landowners need to know. So we'll go over everything from water law to fence law to liability to key estate planning documents. It's free. We're going to all these places. I somehow missed the location on the bottom line there. September 12th, we'll be in College Station. So we'd love to have you if you'd like to come to those. Again, pick up a flyer if you're interested. The other set of programs may fit well for this group. And that's our ranchers leasing workshops. Those ones we charge $50 a person or $80 a couple. Again, we're going to all these different locations around the state. It's sort of a 4-hour presentation on the same topic we're doing today. So it's a half-day program on grazing leases. You get a copy of our grazing lease handbook that we, or leasing handbook that we've put together. It's got checklists for leases, sample lease language, all kinds of information. If you're interested, I'm going to give you my contact information at the end as well. Holler at me. I'll help you get signed up if you want to come to those. And again, flyers at the front. Okay? With that, here's kind of a roadmap of what I'm planning on covering today. The first thing we're going to talk about is why you need a written lease. Then we're going to look at some payment rates. How do we set up, how do we want to structure payment in the lease, and how much should we be charging, right? The next topic is what I call my father's favorite section. You'll see why on that in just a minute. And then we'll talk about grazing leases, farm leases, and hunting leases, and just hit on some specifics for each of those as far as good terms to include. Okay? So let's start off with why we need a written lease. One of the most common questions I get with my job is someone will call up and say, hey, is there like a general lease form everyone uses? Can you just send me that? The answer is a lot of people use a lease that looks like that. Right? Two guys in the pasture. They've known each other their entire lives. They go out, one guy says, I'll lease it to you for X amount. The other guy says, okay. They shake hands and go home. Anybody got oral lease agreements? A lot of those happen, right? And so I'm here today, and I think it may be my mission in life to convince you to put those oral lease agreements in writing, all right? So let's talk about that oral lease in the pasture. Is that valid under Texas law? Is that a valid legal contract? What do we think? Got some yeses, got some noes. A good lawyer likes a dispute, right? So let's look at it. The law says so sometimes. The law says we need a written lease sometimes. Here's the way that works. The general rule is that an oral contract is valid under Texas law. That's our starting place. However, there's something called the statute of frauds. And what that says is there are certain types of contracts that must be in writing to be legally enforceable. One of those contracts is a lease of real estate that lasts a year or more. So if you're going to enter into a multi-year lease, right, a 2, 3, 5 year lease, for that to be a legally enforceable contract, it actually has to be in writing. Now, why do I care if my contract is legally enforceable? Well, here's why. If we end up in a dispute and I have to go to court, the claim I want to make is breach of contract. Guess what the first thing a judge looks for in a breach of contract case? A contract. So in order to have a claim there, I have to have a contract. All right? So that's the first reason we need to think about having a written lease. The second reason is that the exercise of writing it down is helpful. When you're standing in that pasture, you are not going to think of near as many issues or details as if you're sitting down with a pen and a piece of paper. So just the exercise of writing a lease out can be really useful because things will come to your mind. You'll think about things like, well, who's going to repair the fences? Or, well, what are we going to do if the windmill goes down? Right? Those sort of things are going to come to your mind more likely when you're writing it out. The next thing is, if you end up in court, you're going to want a written document. All right? And the reasoning here is this. It is impossible to ever predict what a judge or a jury is going to do. It's even more impossible when you're not trying to base that on something written. At least if you've got a written lease, that's going to let a lawyer or a judge or somebody have something to go on, and that's going to help you be able to analyze the potential strength of your claim. So it can be important there as well. Another thing we're going to talk about is a tenant may want a written lease so they can record it in the county deed records. Now hang with me here. This sounds strange. I get it, all right? First of all, there's no requirement that a lease has to be recorded. Not required, okay? There's also no requirement that a lease has to be notarized. Sometimes that goes around. You don't have to do that. You can. You don't have to, okay? Now why might a tenant want to record a lease? Here's why. It puts people on notice that your lease exists. And when that matters, there's two scenarios when that can be real important. The first one is if property changes ownership during the term of the lease. So let's say I enter into a 5-year lease with Stacy Fox. And 3 years into my lease, she's going to sell the land to somebody else. What happens to me? The way the law works, there's sort of two steps to it. Number one, if we addressed it in the lease, that's the answer. So a lease could say, in the event that the property changes hands during the term, the lease will terminate. And from a landowner perspective, if you're thinking about selling property, that might be something that you want to include. Okay? As a tenant, I'm not going to probably like that term. And frankly, most leases are silent. Most leases don't address what happens if the property sells. So if the lease is silent, the way the law works is the lease continues if the new purchaser was on notice that the lease existed. There are three ways someone can have notice. The first one is actual notice. That means someone told him. So if someone tells the buyer, hey, there's a lease that lasts for 2 more years, now they know. The second way is called constructive notice, and that means that a reasonable person looking at the facts should have known. I hate that. Don't use that. Right? That's mushy. Who knows how that plays out? The third way is called record notice, and that means something has been recorded in the deed records at the courthouse that shows there's a lease. The reason that's probably our best option for a tenant is that puts the world on notice. Okay? Even if they don't go look at the deed records, they're deemed to be on notice that the lease existed. All right? Now, there are some people in here who are feeling antsy and thinking, I'm never recording my lease in the deed records. Why not? It's public record. Right? Everybody doesn't need to know my business. They don't need to know what I'm paying for that lease. That's okay. You can record what's called a memorandum of lease. It just has to say, memorandum of lease. Identify the property, identify who is leasing it, and how long it lasts. Probably want both parties to sign it, and then you file it in the deed records. You don't have to talk anything about the price or the stocking rate or the terms. Okay? And again, where that's important is for a tenant. The other place where this comes into play, and if you were in the session about eminent domain earlier, you're going to see more and more this is an issue for Texas landowners, is if an eminent domain project's going to come across the property, if we're going to get a pipeline or a transmission line during the term of the lease. A lot of times, those companies don't go talk to the tenant and don't think about paying compensation to the tenant because they may not even know there is a tenant. One way to ensure they know about you is to have something recorded in the deed records because they're going to those deed records to pull out, to figure out who the landowner is. If they learn there's this lease, which is considered an encumbrance, that's probably going to be more likely to get you a seat at the table to negotiate your potential damages. Okay? And by the way, best case scenario on that, either whether you're a tenant or a landowner, is you two get together and work against that company to try to up the money. Right? Because if I'm a landowner and I've got a tenant and I can tell that company, look, it's not just me. My tenant's paid me. He's got an interest, too. You're going to have to compensate me more to make me whole. That can be useful. Okay? Last thing I'll say here about written leases, as far as recording them, there are some other agencies that may require a copy of a lease. Like at the FSA office or the NRCS office, if you want to do program sign up and there's a lease, they're going to make you bring them a copy. You can't give them a copy of an oral lease. Okay, your county appraisal district may also want a copy of a written lease in the event that you're using the lease as your justification for your open space valuation on your property taxes. So that's another scenario where needing a written lease could come up. Okay, the last point I'm going to make on why leases should be in writing is that you never know what might happen. The guy on the bay horse in the denim shirt's my dad. He's been in ag his whole life. He's been a landowner. He's been a tenant. He gets it. All right? He's the kind of guy, if you got an oral lease with, you're not going to lose much sleep. The guy on the gray horse is my city boy cousin from Switzerland. He came to visit for Thanksgiving. That's his first time on a horse. He's 40 years old, and he told everyone back home that he basically rode Seabiscuit. Sarge has not run a step since 1985, okay? But he was convinced we had put him on this racehorse. He came for Thanksgiving, okay? Thanksgiving, we preg check calves. That's what my family does. And so he came over to the pens, and the vet was there. And I'm not sure what he thought preg checking would look like. But that vet got started, and he looked at me and said, "If I don't leave now, I'll never have children." And he went back to the house. Here's my point. You got an oral lease with my dad, you're probably not going to have many problems. But heaven forbid something happens to my dad, and the land gets inherited by my Swiss cousin. And now you've got a landowner that doesn't have a clue. He doesn't know how things work, what's normal, why you're doing anything. I promise you, if that's your landowner, you're going to want a written lease. Okay? And if you look at the statistics about the age of agricultural landowners, we're going to see a lot of turnover in the next 20 years. And we're going to have a lot of absentee landowners that may not be the same old good boy system you've got with your current landowner. Yes, sir. The title company would find it if it's recorded in the deed records, because to do their title policy, they're going to do a title search. Otherwise, they may not know about it. And so if there is a lease, if you need to look at that, that's something you need to be asking about, having the landowner, you know, be asked if there's a lease, get the information on that. The title company likely is only going to pull it if it's recorded in those deed records. Yes, sir. That's a good question. So he said a lot of times somebody doesn't lease the entire meets and bounds description. Maybe somebody owns a section and you lease a quarter, right? How am I, or not even a quarter, maybe you just lease the pasture behind the creek. How do I describe that to go record it in the deed records? What you may need to do is do some homework on your own, because the county clerk, you're right, they're not going to know what file that goes in. One way you can look at that potentially is a lot of appraisal districts have their records online, and you can go find the property, kind of figure out where it is. And one thing I like to do for leases in general is attach a map. Because there's nobody, well, maybe not nobody, I sure don't understand meets and bounds descriptions when I read them. So for a lease, I like to attach a map. Print off a Google Earth, highlight, here's what I'm leasing. You could attach that to the memorandum of lease. But you may have to do some homework with the landowner, with the appraisal district, with the county clerk, to figure out the right file for that to go into. But that legwork-wise shouldn't be too complicated, but that map may be a good way to describe it so that everybody understands the piece you're talking about. Okay, let's turn now and talk a little bit about calculating payments. For ag leases, they're generally set up in one of three ways, okay? The first one's a cash lease. Almost all grazing leases are going to be a cash lease. There could be exceptions, but generally that's what we do. And normally you see those either be on a per acre basis or a per head basis. When you talk per head, sometimes people will use per animal unit. We'll talk about what that means in a minute. Okay? That's generally how you see those. They're pretty straightforward, right? You just kind of agree on a price, write it down. There's not a whole lot of confusion that can happen from those. All right? The second option is a crop share lease. We see this more with row crops, all right? But you could do this on cattle, and I suppose potentially if you're taking in cattle on the gain like stalkers, maybe you'd consider that closer to a crop share lease. But the general principle here is that the landowner and the tenant share in certain expenses, and then they share in the revenue, okay? And generally they do it on a percentage basis, and that all depends on what crop you're talking about, where you live, those sort of things. For example, up in our part of the world for cotton, a lot of times it's common to see a one-third, two-third split. If you looked at corn in the Midwest, that's going to be a lot closer to 50-50. So it depends on how you set that. But crop share is an option, okay? The biggest thing on a crop share lease is you want to be real clear on what costs the landowner is going to share in. Because a lot of times it's not every cost, right? So, again, I can only speak from the panhandle farm, you know, context. But up there, a lot of times the landowner is going to share in fertilizer, chemicals, and they're likely not going to share in something like seed. Harvest is iffy. That depends probably on the agreement. But you need to spell that out so you're on the same page. Okay? The third type of lease that's far less common, but it happens some, and I think it's interesting, is called a flex or a hybrid lease. And it kind of combines the first two. So what you might see there is a base rate that's set, and then the price will flex or change based on some external factor. So, for example, if I'm leasing, let's just go with corn. If I'm growing corn, I might lease the place for $20 an acre. And if the price of corn gets above $4, that lease is going to flex up 50 cents an acre. Price of corn gets below $3.50 or whatever the numbers are, it's going to flex down 50 cents. Okay? Normally, you see that flex based on price or on yield. Right? So if I yield over so many bushels, it goes up. Under so many, it goes down. Okay? And that can be an interesting thing to think about from both sides, because if you have a really good year, it lets the landowner benefit a little bit. You got a really bad year, it gives the tenant a bit of a break. So it can be, you know, it's an interesting concept to look at. Again, the devil's in the details here. And you're going to have to be real clear in that contract how this all works, right? So if you say, if the price of corn gets above $4, well, where? When? What board? Okay? You got to spell out all those details and make real sure everybody's on the same page how that flex works. Okay? The one other thing I'll say here looking at this issue is, The way you set up your lease may affect you other places, right? So, for example, the way your lease is structured dictates how payment's going to be made on farm programs at the FSA office, all right? Just by way of example, if you've got land that has base acres and you're getting ARC or PLC payments, a cash lease, the tenant gets all the payment. A share lease, the parties share the payments, just like they would split any other income, okay? So just keep that in mind. I'd also visit with your accountant if you're looking to enter into a new lease or change how it's calculated, because that can affect you as far as Social Security income and self-employment taxes, right? Whether you structure it one way or the other, okay? Let's look now. How much should I charge? And this is not helpful. This is the typical lawyer answer, right? It depends on a bunch of different factors. Here's where I'd start. First thing I do, I call my county extension agent, or I would find a range specialist that's in my area. The good ones, Kara's sitting right here. A good agent like Kara is going to know, right? She's going to be able to come out and look and help you figure it out. We've got range specialists around the state. Some of y'all may have heard Dr. Russell speak yesterday. That's the kind of people that can help you figure out what prices look like. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's true for at least the Title I ARC and PLC programs.
And then you said on the other share, but you didn't say about the flex
tax. The flex lease is going to depend on how the lease is written and how they consider it, how they analyze it down at the FSA office. Now, one thing to keep in mind on that is the parties could always agree to do something different. So, for example, we're leasing a place right now that has base acres. And the PLC payment last year was worth more than the lease we paid. So we made money on the lease. If you know my landlord, keep your mouth shut, okay? But if the landlord knew about that, we could negotiate and we could agree amongst ourselves that we'll split any ARC or PLC payments. Now, FSA is going to pay the way they pay, but I then could owe my landowner some part of the check. Does that make sense? So you could do it different. On a flex lease, it just depends on how it's worded and how your FSA office interprets that as to how they pay. Generally, what they look at is if the landowner has any risk of in the production, any risk, means they're going to treat it more like a share lease.
Market risk?
I think that that would count. And again, I think it probably depends on how the office looks at it. My guess is most offices are going to treat those more like a share lease because they have this production risk. Okay, good question. All right, so how much do I charge? Talk to your county agent. Talk to other landowners and producers. The people on the ground are going to be better than the statistics I'm fixing to give you. Okay? So let's look at some numbers. These are numbers from the government. It's from USDA and NAS. That's the National Ag Statistics Service. These are as accurate as you people are at filling out the little yellow survey that comes in the mail. Okay? I know because I fished my husband's out of the trash last year. And I said, honey, you know I make my living talking about the results of that. You're filling it out. Okay? Take these with a grain of salt. I've done a lot of these programs around the state. I'm told these numbers are usually a little low. But I'm going to give them to you. Okay? The statewide average for Texas, this is not super useful. I'm going to drill down where we get closer to home, okay? Statewide average is $660 an acre. All of these are per acre per year, right? $660. Non-irrigated cropland, $28. Irrigated cropland, $87. Again, that's a statewide, okay? They break it down by region and even by county as well. So if you look at the regions, here they are. Okay, and you got to look up your number, and you can go find this on their website. Now, here's the other thing I'm going to tell you. Their website's awful. Trying to navigate this database is awful. I'll make you an offer. If anybody needs their numbers, you call me or email me, I will give them to you. Okay? Because I promise you can spend 2 hours trying to scroll down and find them. If you need numbers for a specific county, let me know and I'll get them. Okay? I just pulled a couple here of different parts of the state. So the northern high plains region's the panhandle. Pasture land was 720, non-irrigated cropland 3150, and irrigated cropland 139. Okay? I pulled the blacklands region, which is number 40 here. 1350, 23, and 6550. And then I pulled the Edwards Plateau, which is 70, kind of here, hill country area. 330, 14, and 6350. Okay? So again, you can pull your own, and you can even drill down to your county as well. All right? The other thing you need to look at is the Texas Rural Land Value Trends Report. You can Google this, or as soon as the new one comes out in April, I'll have it on my blog. All right? But this is a report put out by an appraisal group, and what it does is it takes the entire state of Texas, puts it into like 7 regions, and then 5 or 6 sub-regions per region. So you'll see, you'll get like a, I don't know, 6 or 8 county little block here. And for each one, they give you a report that looks like this. Breaks land into different categories, right? Cropland, improved, native pasture. Sometimes they'll have irrigated. Sometimes it has hunting leases. Gives you the property value if you were to sell it a range. And it gives you a rental range. Okay? That's pretty useful as well. Again, the new one's going to be out in April, right, for this year. So you can check that out as well. And if you want to follow my blog, it'll be on there. Okay? Yes, sir?
What's called the
Texas Rural Land Value Trend Report.
Thank you.
Yep, it's a mouthful. The group that puts it together is more of a mouthful.
Can you repeat that at one
point? Yeah, no problem. Texas Rural Land Value Trend Report. And again, I'm going to give you my blog in a minute. If you will follow my blog, I'll do a whole post when it comes out and you can get it there. Okay. My father's favorite section. My dad has had free legal advice for 10 years. Okay? We still have leases that aren't in writing. I preach and preach, and there's that verse in the Bible about how a prophet can't be a prophet in his hometown. Living it. Okay? So about a year ago, he calls and he says, hey, we leased the Ford place across the road. I want you to do a written lease. I'm thinking a miracle has occurred. And then he follows up and says, but I don't want all your legal crap in there. You get one page. Okay? So I wrote a one-page lease. Does it have everything I ideally would want in a lease? No. Do I feel better about that one pager than I do the nothing we had before? Sure do. Okay? So one thing to take home here is leases don't have to be super complicated. It doesn't have to be an adversarial process. You can sit down, landowner and tenant together, and write it up. Something in writing is going to be better than nothing. Okay? So I call this my father's favorite section because this is all the legal crap that we don't have in our lease. The first thing is something to address assignments or subleasing. Okay? So if I lease my land to Stacy, can Stacy then go sublease it to somebody else? Texas law says she has to get my permission to sublease. But unless you've taken the bar exam, you probably don't know that. Okay? And so I always say to include it in the lease. What's the rules on subleasing? Okay? The next thing is to think about is a forum clause. Okay? This is important if you're leasing to somebody not from your area. So here's our example. We just leased our ranch hunting rights to a guy that lives in Austin. In the lease, we have a forum clause in there that says, in the event of a dispute, any legal proceedings will be filed in Quay County, New Mexico. Okay? What's the rationale for that? I don't want him filing suit against me in Austin. Right? I don't want to go to Austin every time we have a hearing. And if I'm picking a jury, I want hometown advantage. Right? I want to pick from my neighbors, not a bunch of people in Austin. So if you're leasing to your next door neighbor, this doesn't matter. But if you're leasing to somebody even from a different county or for sure from a different part of the state, a forum clause can be real important. The next thing is watch. Some leases will have a dispute resolution clause. Dispute resolution is great. The idea here is if we can settle disputes outside of court, we're always going to be better off than having to go to a trial. So sometimes you'll agree to do mediation or arbitration. Before you can ever file a lawsuit, you agree to do mediation or arbitration. There are benefits to both, but they're different. I want to explain the difference real quick. Mediation is where both parties, the plaintiff and the defendant, go sit in a room with a third-party mediator. And the mediator kind of does a kumbaya and tries to get everybody to agree to settle. If both parties agree to settle, well, the case settles. You write up a settlement agreement, we succeeded. If both parties don't agree, then the mediation just failed and either one can go file a lawsuit in court tomorrow. Okay? Arbitration's different. You still got a plaintiff and a defendant and an arbitrator, or sometimes it's a panel of three arbitrators. But now the plaintiff puts on his case, the defendant puts on his case, and the arbitrators make a ruling. And normally that ruling is going to be something you can file in court, and it's treated just like a judgment from a judge. Essentially, you trade your day in court for your day in arbitration. You can't go to court just because you don't like the arbitrator's result. Okay? There are reasons to do that. It's faster. It's cheaper. Okay? I'm just telling you, make sure you understand what you're agreeing to if you see or include those terms. The next thing is an attorney fee provision. If you've paid a lawyer, you're going to be shocked to know we're not cheap. Right? And the general rule in America is that win, lose, or draw, both sides pay their own lawyer. One way to change that is by a clause in a contract. And the clause can say something along the lines of, in the event of a legal dispute, the prevailing party can recover their reasonable attorney fees. And that will let the winner recover their attorney fees from the loser. Okay? The last two things I'll mention here, we talked a lot about this yesterday morning, liability and indemnification clauses. Your lease should have those included. And what the liability clause says is just the landowner is not liable for the acts of the tenant and vice versa. Okay? The indemnification clause goes a step further and says in the event that the landowner gets sued because of something the tenant did, the tenant's going to indemnify the landowner. That means they're going to hold them harmless. They'll pay a judgment against them. They will cover attorney fees. And those should probably be reciprocal, right, where it works both ways. Indemnification for the tenant and for the landowner. All right? Every lease seems to have those clauses in them. Yes, sir?
Are those two clauses the one that will protect in case someone gets injured or killed on the leasee?
Yeah, so the idea here, well, yes and no. The idea here is if the tenant does something wrong and the tenant's the one that caused the injury, this keeps the landowner from being liable, okay? And it makes the tenant reimburse essentially the landowner for costs to not be liable, legal costs, et cetera, okay? Now, could a tenant still be found liable if an injury occurs on the property? Yes. So this isn't a magic thing to keep you from being liable. It just keeps you from being liable for the actions of the other party, landowner or tenant. Does that make sense? Okay? And it's just real quick, as far as liability goes during the term of a lease, the general rule is that a landowner is not liable for injuries during the lease, okay, unless they did something that's other than just be a landowner. For example, if in the lease the landowner says, I agree to repair fences, and then doesn't, he can be liable for that, but that's not just because he is the landowner. And the rationale for that is technically under the law, when I lease my property to somebody, I technically don't have the right to even enter that property during the lease. I realize that's not how we do it in the real world, okay? But that's what the law says. And so the law is not going to hold me liable when I can't even enter the property anyway. Okay, so generally, landowner's not liable during the term of the lease. That said, every landowner needs liability insurance on all of your property. Even if you are leasing it out, have liability insurance. Every tenant needs liability insurance on your property. Even the property that you're just leasing. I told the story yesterday. I had a fire insurance agent because I called and said, I need you to add these 50 acres that we're leasing, add liability coverage. He said, okay. 2 months later, when I review the policy, I notice it's not on there. I call and say, I don't see the addition. He says, well, since it's so close to your house, you don't need to worry about it. It's just covered. No, it's not just covered. Yes, ma'am. Well, the answer from me is always going to be everybody needs it. So I would want each person to have an insurance policy. And listen, liability insurance on something like that is not very expensive, guys. In the scheme of, we added 50 acres, I think it was like $60 a year to have liability insurance on that property. Okay? Let's look now at a few pointers for a grazing lease. I have a handbook. If you all are interested, it's a handbook on agricultural leases. It's free. You can download a copy on my website, or if you will contact me, you want a hard copy, I'll mail you one. Okay? And it's got checklists and sample language for grazing, hunting, and livestock leases. All right? It's like an 8-page checklist for grazing leases. I pulled 4 things. So I'm not telling you everything today, but this is kind of 4 I thought were important to talk about. The first thing is set a stocking rate. Now, I am telling you this is the number one thing you should do in a grazing lease, but when I wrote the lease for my dad, or the one pager, I didn't include this. Why not? Who was my dad in the lease? The tenant. Is a tenant going to fight to set a stocking rate to limit how many cows he can have? Nope. Look, would we have signed it if the landlord asked for it? Yep. He didn't ask. We didn't put it. Okay? So the point I'm making there is when you look at a checklist or something, think about what side you're on and what terms you're going to want to really fight for to include. Because you may have a situation like ours where I drafted a lease that I thought was pretty tenant-friendly and the landowner just signed it. I'm glad I didn't throw in a bunch of extra landowner-friendly terms. Okay? Now, if I'm a landowner, this is the number one term I want, no questions asked. Okay? A stocking rate just says how many cattle you can have on the property. Why do I care about this as the landowner? I've got to protect my resource, right? So what I want to avoid is some tenant coming in, leasing it for a year, bringing every cow he's ever seen, right? Grazes it down to the dirt, and when he leaves, my resource is in shambles. I can't lease it again. I can't run my own cattle on it. We've got a mess. So the stocking rate helps protect that. How do I know how many cattle I can put out there? That's where, again, I've talked to my county agent. I'm talking to the range specialist around here to help me figure out that number. Yes, sir?
As a tenant,
sure, the lawyer in me, that makes me cringe because I'm like, oh, Lord, what does any of that mean, right? But I think the point you made is a great one, and I made this before we started. A lot of times in our world, it's tough to find land to lease. Anybody else dealing with that? We are. And look, if I got to put something in there to make a landowner feel warm and fuzzy, I'm putting it in there. Those rates we put on the board, I'm paying triple that for a lease for my cows right now. And I was happy to write that check because we had a chance to get it. So look, you're going to have some concessions on both sides, okay? If a landowner asks for a stocking rate, I'm not going to blink. I'm going to get it. I'm happy to do it, okay? So on the stocking rate, you can do that in a number of ways. A lot of times you'll see you can run so many head, right? So let's say I got a place and I say, all right, you can run 50 head of cows. The one thing you may want to consider as the landowner is, what size of cows are we talking about, right? Because the amount of feed a 1,000-pound Angus cow is going to eat versus a 1,500-pound Charolais cow, there's a difference. Same thing with stocker calves. Are we talking 400-pound calves or 800-pound calves, right? So one way to deal with the size issue is you could talk about it with your tenant and agree, you know, you can have so many 1,000-pound cows or whatever. An easier way is to use animal units as a form of measurement. For animal units, one cow is 1,000 pounds. Okay? You got a 1,000-pound cow, that's one animal unit. Got a 1,500-pound cow, she's 1.5. So if I said you could run 50 animal units, now that automatically takes size into consideration. Okay, so that's one thing to think about. And there's animal unit measurements for all sorts of animals. You all probably don't care, but I'm a sheep person. So it's 6 sheep is one animal unit. Okay, and there's a chart in my handbook that lists out horses and deer and all kinds of stuff if you need that. Okay? The other thing here, that number may need to change based on drought or wildfire. Okay? In New Mexico, where I live, we run a cow to about every 35 acres. Don't fall over, people from Central Texas. I said a cow to every 35 acres. Okay? I promise you, in 2012, nobody was running a cow to every 35 acres. And so this is particularly important, I think, if you go into a long-term lease, if you're going to lease something for 5 years, you may want to revisit that stocking rate once a year, for example, just to make sure that it's still kosher. All right? So that's my spiel on stocking rates. What can be done on the property? This is something important to include. Okay? That what you need to assume is if you don't include limitations, they don't exist. So if I lease my land to somebody and I just say, I lease my land to Stacy, what can Stacy do out there? Whatever she wants, right? She can run cows, she can run sheep, she can have her kids barrel horses, she can ride four-wheelers, she can have, you know, I don't know, picnics with loud music and beer, whatever. She can do whatever she wants. If you want to limit something, make sure you write that in the lease. So a lot of times you'll see, I will lease this property to them for grazing cattle only. Okay? And if there are certain things they can't do, spell that out. So by way of example, we just did a hunting lease and we said that they could hunt any species that they were able to get the proper documentation from New Mexico Parks and Wildlife, except for pheasants. So we wrote in there, you can't hunt pheasants. Those are the kind of limitations. If you want those, you need to include them. Are there any areas off limits to the tenant? That goes back to, right, I'll lease you this one pasture, not the whole land. Maybe I'll let you use the pasture, but you can't use the corrals. Spell that out in your lease. And then I always say, save yourself a tent situation in November. What happens about the first weekend in November? Deer season. And everybody who's ever set foot on your property has some cockamamie theory about why they're the ones that have the hunting rights. Okay? If you lease your land for grazing, in the lease, say who has the hunting rights. Okay? Are you leasing them to the tenant? Are you reserving them to yourself? If you do lease them to the tenant, can they sublease them to someone else? You need to spell all that out in the lease. Because I always say it's better to deal with this when you're sitting across a table with a pen, not standing across a fence with firearms. All right? And that comes up a lot. The next thing to look at is maintenance of fixed assets. Who's going to repair or maintain assets during the term of the lease. Fences are a big one. Who's going to repair and maintain fences? Okay? And understand, from a fairness, practical standpoint, I like it when the parties split fence costs. You don't have to do it that way. That's how we do it. In fact, most of our fixed assets, the way we write them, is the landowner pays for materials, the tenant pays for labor. I'm just telling you what we do, okay? Here's the rationale, right? If I'm a tenant and I've got to go build 5 miles of fence at $10,000 to $15,000 a mile, what happens when my lease leaves? My fences stay. And I've just spent all this money that's now going to benefit the next dang tenant. I don't love that, right? So if I'm a tenant, I'm sure asking the landowner to share in some of those costs. As a landowner, I think that makes sense to me. If I'm going to get a good fence that stays when that guy leaves, maybe that's a good deal. All right? Regardless of how you set it up, think about that. From the landowner perspective, I always like a clause that requires the tenant to periodically inspect and immediately repair damaged fences. If you were in our session yesterday, we talked a lot about fence law. Okay? This is a real good clause. If cattle get out on the highway, get hit, and someone gets sued, as a landowner, I like to point right to this and say that it was on the tenant to inspect and repair those fences. It was probably on the tenant anyway, but I just like to go ahead and have that in there. It's a good piece of evidence to blow up and put on a projector one day. All right? We talked about liability earlier. Other issues that come up, sources of water, if you've got a windmill or a pump or whatever, who's going to pay for repairs on those? That happens, arguments that come up a lot. Okay? The last thing I want to just mention here briefly is the mineral estate. Okay? If you're a tenant, you may want to know if there is a mineral lease on that property or one being negotiated. Now, that may be harder than we think to find out. I'm not going to chase this ball down forever. But if I live somewhere where there's a lot of mineral production, it may matter to me if there's a lease on that property, a mineral lease on that property I'm about to lease for grazing. And here's why, right? Under Texas law, the mineral estate is dominant, and that mineral owner has his right to use as much of the surface as is reasonably necessary to produce the minerals. Which means if I got a place leased for my cows and the minerals get leased out, all of a sudden I may have a 5-acre drilling pad and all the traffic that comes with that in roads and gathering lines and disposal wells in the middle of the property I paid to lease. Okay? I want to know, A, if something, I think that's going to be a problem. The other thing as a tenant, I may want to have something in the lease that says in the event that happens, I have the right to cancel the lease and get a refund of any money I paid ahead. Okay? So just something to think about, keep in mind from the tenant perspective when we're dealing with minerals. Okay? Questions on grazing leases before we switch gears a little bit? Yes, sir. There's two options, right? Small claims court is an option to go and sue for a breach of contract if you need to get damages back and to officially terminate the lease. Eviction proceedings would be to kick him off. If you can say, look, you breached the lease, you got to get off here, and he won't get off, you can do an eviction just like homeowners. And you got to jump through all those hoops, right? Give notice, so many days, yada, yada. So kind of both is the answer to your question, depending on what you're seeking. If you're just seeking to evict them for a material breach, you can do eviction proceedings. If you're wanting to recover monetary damages, it's probably going to be small claims court.
What if there was no agreement?
Well, then you should have come to my session sooner. No, so his question is, what if there was no written lease? What if it's just an agreement that's been in place for 15 years? Yeah, how do we evict somebody in that situation? If we never had a written lease, that's where things can get a little bit hairy, okay? Look, if you don't have a written lease, okay, and I'm the landowner, I'm probably going to be able to go through the eviction procedure and evict you because you can't prove you've got any right to be there. Now, if I've been taking your checks every year for the last 15 years and you've paid me for this entire year and I'm going to kick you out in February, that's not going to maybe be the same, okay? But I'll tell you the other thing. The first thing I do, if you have written or oral leases, go get them in writing. The other place this pops up is, let's say somebody had a lease 10 years ago for a year, and then it expired, but you kept leasing it for the next 10 years. The law, these two are looking at each other like, oh, that's us, okay? The law says the terms of that first lease are going to be presumed to still be in place, okay? We're just going to imply those because you kept acting like it was, okay? And that can be fine. So if you had that original lease, you could use that as the lease to terminate, okay? But the other thing is there may be some terms in there from 15 years ago that aren't great. So we may need to get that redone so we're not dealing with 15-year-old terms as well. Yes, sir?
I think one thing that's important coming from a row crop area is that if you're going to have those problems, send it certified mail.
For sure, yes.
And there are timelines for terminating share leases and other type leases at the FSA office.
Yeah, he says if you're going to do any sort of, that applies to eviction stuff too, terminating leases, anything like that, send those letters certified mail. Send a letter, okay? Write it down. Send it certified mail where you can prove that that happened. And that's another thing to watch for when you're drafting leases, especially I think from a tenant perspective. Make sure you get a good amount of notice before that lease is going to end, right? Because you got to find somewhere else to put those cows. So as a tenant, to me, that's a term I'm going to fight for. I want 60 days notice before they can terminate me, or 90 days notice. Because I'm going to have to scramble and find something else. And then you better abide by those notice deadlines if they're in that agreement. Okay? Let's shift and look at hunting leases here for just a minute. Hunting leases require everyone to sign the lease and waivers. We talked at length about waivers yesterday. For hunters, I want 3 documents from everybody coming on my property. Okay? I want a lease, a standard waiver of liability. I say standard, there's not a form or anything, but just a regular waiver of liability. And then I want the language from the Texas Agritourism Act. That, or I want to hang up the Agritourism Act sign. You can do either one of those. Okay? But now understand what I'm saying. Anybody that comes on the property, I want them to sign a lease. So if I lease to a guy and he's going to bring his brother-in-law and his wife, I want those people to sign a lease too. Why? I want them bound by the terms of my lease. And if they didn't sign it, they're not bound. Okay? The other thing is, I want to know, and I put this in every hunting lease, anybody who's going to come on that property needs to be approved in writing by me, the landowner. And that's because, A, I want to know who's out there, and B, I want to make sure I can chase them down to get my waivers signed. Okay? So that's a clause to think about there as well. Limits on hunting methods. This is something to think about. Can they use tree stands or deer blinds or feeders? If they can they put them out? When do they need to be off? Can they screw them into the tree or do they have to be freestanding? If those details matter, you need to include those kind of things. Are there any types of weapons that are prohibited? Some people don't mind archery, but they don't want firearms. Something like that. Can ATVs be used on the property? That's a big one. Number one claim in hunting-related accidents is ATVs. Okay? I'm going to give you one just side note thought on that. Long story. There are some plaintiff's lawyers that have gotten this theory that there's a provision in the transportation code that says a 16-year-old cannot operate an ATV unsupervised. I've seen a couple of cases where somebody who was 16 or 15 was riding around on a four-wheeler on the ranch, has an accident, injures somebody else, and that family is using that code provision against the landowner and says, landowner, you let them ride together and you didn't have somebody supervising them. I sure might think about if you're going to allow ATV use and you got people under 16 requiring adult supervision, okay? Just think about it, because that's popping up. I've seen it a couple times now. I'm not sure how a court sorts that out, but I've seen lawyers using it. We talked about insurance. Make sure that you have it. We'll go on from that. Yes, sir?
Is
Under that statute, it says children under 16 and under, I think is how it's worded. Adult supervision would be 18 and up. Yes, sir? Let's talk about waivers and minor children. Okay, waivers. Generally in Texas, courts will enforce a liability waiver. Would it include that language? It depends on your waiver. Okay, that's probably where I put it, would be in the waiver. All right? But here's the only kicker on waivers. A lot of times we will have a parent sign a waiver on behalf of a minor. The Texas Supreme Court's never ruled on this, but there are several appellate court opinions that say we will not enforce a liability waiver signed on behalf of a minor because we think it's against public policy. I still get them. I'd still have it because it might be enforceable. It might not. So just keep that in the back of your head. If you've got minors, so anybody under 18 on the property doing a recreational purpose, I 100% for sure would have the signed language from the Agritourism Act. Your option is you can hang up a sign or get a release. Get that release language because the legislature expressly said that release could be signed by the participant or their parent or guardian. That looks to me like your best bet to enforce a waiver against a minor. It's in that Agritourism Act. It's a paragraph long. I would print it by itself on a separate piece of paper and have the parent sign it. I think that's your best bet for minors. I have 2 minutes. This is not good. Okay. We're going to skip. These are not super important. It's all important. We got to go fast. There is a requirement that landowners leasing out their property for hunting, if you're getting something of value, you as the landowner have to get a hunting lease license from the Texas Parks and Wildlife. This is separate from the hunting license you need to go shoot something. This says if I'm a landowner, I've got to pay to get a license to lease my land. You can Google it. Just be aware of it. If you need more info, holler at me. I can get it for you. We talked about these statutes yesterday. We just don't have time. Additional resources, I mentioned that handbook I helped author. If you want a copy, you can get it on my website or holler at me and I'll get you a hard copy. Especially for row crop leases, there's a website called AgLease 101. They've got great forms and great checklists and stuff there. Okay? The last slides I'm going to give you are how to contact me. This is my website. It's my blog. If you'll sign up with your email, everything I post will come to you like an email. If you want to download that handbook, go to Publish Materials. Okay? You can download it right there. I've got a podcast. Podcast you can listen on your phone or on the computer at that address there. I interview an ag lawyer every episode. We've done hunting leases, landowner liability. Go back a slide. Okay? We've done hunting leases. We've done landowner liability. The last slide I'm going to put up has all my contact info. So if you're frantically writing these down, this is the slide you want, okay? It's got my phone number, my email, social media. There's the blog. There's the podcast. Questions? I'm going to stick around. I think we have to go. I'll stick around. If y'all have questions, come see me. Thank you.
Let's give her a round of applause. She does a great job. If you have any questions, feel free to come ask her. She'll be sticking around for a little bit. If not, thank you so much for attending the School for Successful Ranching, and we hope you have a wonderful afternoon.
Potentially. I don't love the Beware of Dog sign because it does make it look like it's a dangerous dog. In Texas, the way the law works is it's called the one free bite rule, which sounds crazy.
Oh, okay.
But essentially, if you don't know your dog is vicious.
Also, since she didn't mention them again at the end, if you wanted those two flyers about the different events coming up, we have them up here on this front table. So go ahead and come grab them.
That's why the sign makes you antsy. Because you don't want to ever admit that you know your dog is vicious.
Okay. Just
right. Now, if you do know your dog is vicious and he's bit somebody before, I'm probably hanging up the sign just to try to keep somebody out because I'm already screwed on that. Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll let you.
Yeah, sure.
Handle all that.
No. Hi.
My name's Mo Ship. I just wanted to introduce myself.
Yes. From Twitter. Yes.
That's
it's
right.
Nice
and
to
I was
going to
give you my card too.
Perfect.
Do you ever need something on the estate planning side or to bounce stuff off of each other?
I do.
Love to work.
That would be awesome. And I'm always looking for people in San Antonio for referrals.
Okay,
so,
cool.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Great.
Well,
so nice to meet you.
I know my husband and I are like, oh my gosh, we're fanboys and girls.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Thank you
thank
for coming.
You for
I appreciate
here.
It.
I'm a retired corporate security.